The Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio is on the air.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema, your source for in-depth discussion of cult cinema. Tonight we speak with Not of Street of Pink Ava DVD on Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. Film that matters, cult, grindhouse, drive-in, independent, and underground film from the dawn of the talkies through the early 90s. Tonight, we speak with Not of Street of Pink Ava DVD, one of two men behind the only company on the market exclusively focused on Japanese pink film, otherwise known as Roman porn. Not of and his partner, Ayumu Oda, have dug deep into the Japanese cinematic netherworld to license over 100 of these uniquely stylish erotic films for worldwide release, bringing us the first ever Western releases, such notable series as S&M Hunter, Molester Train, and more. Pink Ava is only at the beginning of its career, with planned releases ranging from the halcyon days of the 70s right through the modern day. Join us as we speak to Not of Street right here on Third Eye Cinema. We have with us today one of two men behind Pink Ava, the only company on the market exclusively focused on Japanese pink film, otherwise known as Roman porn. Not of Street, along with his partner Ayumu Oda, have dug deep into the Japanese cinematic netherworld to license over 100 of these uniquely stylish erotic films for worldwide release. Nanav, welcome to Third Eye Cinema.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Pink Ava, the company, is not the first or only DVD company to release these films, but you are the only one to exclusively specialize in them and to include so many with an actual and obvious sense of humor, which was an integral part of the genre, but underrepresented on these shores in favor of the more familiar serious-style softcore. So tell us about the history of Pink Ava, the company. How did you discover these films and get involved with releasing them?
Well, this story spans back to about 5 years ago.
Right.
I have a post-production studio in Los Angeles. We do editorial on TV shows and movies and good stuff like that.
Right.
And Ayumu was working with us, and he basically tried to introduce me to the genre one day. He gave me a DVD. He was sitting in a bar in Tokyo on one of his vacation weeks. He went to Tokyo for his vacation, and he sat in a bar with Mr. Daisuke Goto, who directed Blind Love.
Right.
And they got to talking and became really good friends. And he gave him a bunch of screeners of his movies to watch.
Right.
And he spent his nights and weekends translating Blind Love into English. And he told me, hey, you want to watch this movie? It's really cool. And I said, what is it? And he said, oh, you know, it's porn like shit. I mean, that's Ayumu and his limited English. That's as far as he could take it. And he said, porn? I said, porn? We can't touch that with a stick. Not in our line of business. We dealt at the time with a lot of, like, television clients, and we didn't really want to, you know, mix the two worlds here. And then I guess there was one day that my wife was out, and I just said, hey, you know what? I might just watch this porn like shit that I got from Ayumu.
Right.
And I popped the DVD in, and I was blown away, literally. It was probably the best movie I had seen in a long time. You know, I knew the budget on it. I knew it was a stringent budget, but the story just grabbed me. I loved it. I mean, I was expecting to see porn,
right,
and I got to see erotica in its most natural story form alive. And it was all shot on 35 film, and, you know, because it was kind of a cheaper production, so then the editing was rudimentary, but the story was so good, the performances were so great, it was a great film. And
right.
So right away I told Ayumu that I loved it. I said, this is amazing. How do we get more of these? We should have a bunch of them.
Right.
And we got in touch with Mr. Goto, the director, and he pointed us to the people that are actually the production companies that make these, and we became good friends with them over time, and we are now distributing their products.
So how did you actually get involved with Ayumu in the first place? Was he working with you at your other job?
Yeah, we have a post-production facility. Like, we just do editing and DVD authoring.
Right.
And he was just working with us. Yeah, he was just one of the guys. We had some people working here, and he was one of them. And this was something that he did, again, during his spare time on the weekends. And putting together the subtitles on this, he basically, Mr. Ayumu Oda is the person who brought Pink Eggad to America.
Right. So let's discuss the history of Pink Eggad genre a bit. I believe from the 70s through the early 90s, most Pink film originated from one studio, Nakatsu. I won't get into the entire history of the studio, but suffice to say that by the early 60s, they were becoming famous for their explorations of contemporary culture, first with the Sun Tribe films, which were very much akin to 50s JD films, Sex, Violence, and Anarchy Among the Disaffected Youth of the Day. Several long-standing matinee idols started out in these films, but unfortunately, a few of them made it to these shores. Criterion brought us Crazed Fruit, Something Weird has the Weird Lovemakers, also known as the Warped Ones, which I think Criterion might have just put that out under that title. But that's about it, those two films, and it's a shame. From here, they had moved on into action crime films with directors like Seijun Suzuki and stars like Joe Shishido and Akira Kobayashi, and thankfully these have been somewhat better represented, again from Criterion with their Nakatsu Noir set, Black Type Killers from Image, and a few films from Kino Lorber like Cops vs. Thugs and one of my favorites, 3 Seconds Before Explosion. But unfortunately, by the end of the 60s, it became apparent that television was taking away the audience who traditionally looked to film for escapist entertainment. So studios were looking for new angles to get butts in the theater seats, essentially. So Nakatsu had decided to jump into the skin market with what was referred to as Roman porn, which is a derivation of romantic porno, more commonly known as softcore films. They made something of a cottage industry out of these films and even worked with some variant genre blends, such as the much-blood pinky violence subgenre, before once again dying out in the early 90s due to the advent of DVD. I understand that Nakatsu very recently came back, and we're talking about, I think it's like 2010, but there have been other independent companies who stepped into the breach in the meantime and released pink films throughout that period, some of which you offer. So let's talk about this genre. Explain to the listeners how the pink films differ from straight porn or U.S.-style softcore.
Well, yeah, I guess what you're saying about Nakatsu is true. We primarily work with two other studios in Japan. One is called Kokuei Pictures, and one is called Shintoho Pictures. And they've been making these films for 50 years now. So it's even the 50th anniversary, Ayumu here is saying. The 50th anniversary of Pink Eggad this year. So what happens is they've been doing this before Nakatsu was making Nakatsu Roman porn.
Right.
So this is basically where the genre started. So we kind of went to the source on these. And I guess in terms of the difference, because of the Japanese censorship laws, there's no frontal nudity on these, and all the acts are simulated.
Right.
And basically, the way I see it is, like, if you're coming to Pink Eggad to, like, get your, you know, sexy fix, you should probably look elsewhere. This is more, it's more kind of, it's a movie that'll get you into the mood, but it's not like one of those dirty, grinding, gonzo porn films that you would see in the United States. And I guess that's probably one of our biggest genres, problem with this genre, is the fact that people slightly misunderstand what we do, and they think that it's like, oh, you guys are releasing that Japanese porn stuff. It's not porn. It's erotica. It's based on performance. It's very highly entertaining films. Like, the comedies are great screwball comedies.
Right.
Some of them directed by Mr. Yojiro Takeda, who actually won an Oscar for Departures. We have 12 of his films lined up for release. These are, like, the top-notch artists and filmmakers in Japan in terms of, you know, even actors and cinematographers, people that were trying to break into the film industry in Japan. They got their first attempt done on Pink Eggad.
Right, very true.
It's a training ground for people that want to explore. I mean, the way they do it is the budgets are really small. They'll give you, say, $50,000 to make a movie. They give that to the director and say, all right, here's $50,000. Make your movie. If you can make the movie for less, everything that you saved, you can take home. If you make it for more, you have to pay the difference. So basically, the people that do these are really good directors. They're really good actors. They're really good cinematographers. Everything is shot one take. Like, they never have any additional takes. Like, in, I don't know if you've seen Twilight Dinner, our latest release. There's a very bloody scene in a bathtub there with a very intricate sequence of action, and that was shot in 4 hours. That's something that over here in Hollywood, it would take them 5 days to shoot.
Exactly right. I think that Pink Eggad has a lot more in common with the French or Italian style softcore, because, like you mentioned, it's still shot on 35mm film. There's an emphasis on plot, and as you had mentioned again, it attracts young directors who get their start and hone their craft there before moving on, because there's this great sense of freedom and latitude to pursue a creative or tourist vision, so long as they include sex scenes every so often. I think with Nakatsu, the official director was something like every 7 minutes, but as long as they did that.
Yeah, they're basically 4-reel films. Every reel is 2,000 feet of film. They shoot them in 4 different reels. That's how they project them in the theaters. There has to be a sex scene in each reel.
Right.
So then it's on a 60-minute film, you'll see, yeah, like every 7 or 8 minutes there's a sex scene. Although nowadays, people are breaking that a little bit, you know. They figure, you know, there are some directors like director Goto, who did In Love and A Lonely Cow Weeps at Dawn. He's got less sex scenes in his films. And then you'll never see a sex scene in a Pink film that does not relate to the plot.
Right.
It's not like, you know, in porn, like if you watch, you know, the porn online or something, you just see people at it.
Right.
In a Pink film, there's always, it's used as a device to move the story forward. It's like it's always, he's always meeting his next door neighbor and they are going to do something later on. It somehow ties into the story.
Right. And you're right about what you said before. I mean, I sort of started to disagree with you, is that, you know, you can't get into the mood from these films, because you can, but that's kind of where it stops, because it's not like full on hardcore porn. This is, you know, an erotic film. It's a softcore film, basically.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, I think they're really great. I think they're very, it's more of a tingly kind of feeling that you would get from them than
right.
a feeling of like a great lustiness kind of feel, just because, you know, our taste nowadays in porn is so much more explicit.
Exactly.
And these, there's a lot of implicit, it really leaves a lot to your imagination. And
right.
that's a great thing about it. I think that's good.
Exactly.
I mean,
it harkens back to the older style of filmmaking.
Oh, yeah. This is old school. I mean, the way they do them, they cut them on flatbeds also. I mean, the way that they produce these films is just amazing. I mean, all of us here, we're all basically, we come from film school and we're classically trained in film. And these people, they shoot a movie in a week. They shoot it in 4 days, and then they edit it in a week on a flatbed, and then they do the sound mix, and then it's ready. A movie's ready in 3 weeks.
Right.
It's just how it's a fast, highly skilled, highly creative approach to the business. Right.
And yet they churn them out at such a rate that it actually, I think I heard some point that the total films made in Japan during certain years, I think a good portion of that, like, I don't know, 70% of it is actually Pink films, because there's so many.
Two-thirds of the films produced in Japan are Pink films.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a good 65% and up. It's true. But then, again, we've had the great fortune to hang out with a lot of the talent, because we bring people over here when there's screenings. We'll bring some of the actresses in, and we brought some directors to America, to some film festivals, and we get to talk to them. And when you meet a director who's directed 120 films,
right,
then they can work fast. They know what they need, and they just go ahead and get it.
Exactly. And there's no way that these guys are not going to be skilled just from experience, from doing so many films.
Oh, yes.
I think the only real downer for us on these shores is that the films generally run only about 60 minutes so that they can fit on triple bill screenings over in Japan. But you can definitely say that on the whole, they run a fairly tight ship, because that's not 60 wasted minutes. Like nowadays, you know, you watch a movie and it's just kind of a big buildup. These are breezy little films that say what they need to inside of that time frame, and they'd likely outstay their welcome if they were in a longer edit. So it actually feels right. Even though it's such a short time, it feels like, okay, it got in, it did what it had to do, it's done. And there you go. One thing that might be hard for U.S. audiences to believe or understand is that there's actually a huge groundswell of feminist interest in these now in Japan. What do you think led to the shift in how these films are viewed?
Well, I think times have changed in Japan as well. If I could get back to the previous point, though, first of all, thanks for saying that it goes by so fast. It is breezy, I agree. 60 minutes is a lot less than a standard feature in the U.S.
Right.
But what we do at Pink Ega is we try to put as many DVD extras on the releases that we can.
Right.
So that we try to fill the program out with a bunch of extra material and a bunch of extra content, which you don't get if you live in Japan, and you don't get anywhere. We're the only people that are doing this. We figure nobody will ever release these films again. Nobody will re-release Twilight Dinner. So
exactly.
The release that we give to it is the only one it'll ever get. And if we have to go and get an interview with the director, we will. If we can get an interview with the actress, we will, because we think the audience would love that.
Right.
And that kind of fills out the program. In terms of how the audience perceives the content, I think, you know, now with the internet around, despite the strict censorship laws in Japan for, you know, frontal nudity, like everything in Japan is supposed to be mosaiced, as
right.
I'm sure you know, I think people can find, like, dirtier, quote-unquote, dirtier porn now.
Oh, yeah.
So then the male audience that used to come to the movie theaters in the afternoon during their lunch hour to just see some tits on the big screen, they figured out a different way to do that. They can see that on their phones now.
Right.
But for women, the taste in erotica is always bigger. I mean, even over here, it's like if you'll get 2 DVDs at home and sit with your missus and say, hey, which one do you want to watch? And one of them is a really dirty, you know, the porn version of The Simpsons, and the other one is a great erotic story. She'll want to watch the erotic film, because that's what women are more interested in that aspect. And so I think now in Japan, more than in the past, women are allowing themselves to say that they're interested in these films, where in the past they would be too embarrassed to admit it. Now it seems like something that's a little more accepted.
Right, because these films were once the province of, like, sleazy theaters, similar to the U.S. grindhouses, but the fair limited itself only to pink film and excluded the sort of outrage kind of films that were usually associated here. Like, you know, they didn't have Ilsa films, they didn't have race films, they didn't have Italian gore films. It's just, you go there to see pink films and that's it. But now, with this feminist interest, they're actually having screenings and, you know, little, like, nicer setups, I guess. And women are going to see this. I've actually seen some extras. I'm not sure if it was on your discs or if I saw it elsewhere. But I've actually seen a gaggle of basically just women. There's no guys there going to see whatever this pink film was. And it was fascinating because you don't picture that at all. Usually when you think, okay, it's involved with sex, even though it's not, you know, a porno or whatever, this is a guy thing. And yet, I mean, that's not the case anymore. It really has flipped.
Yeah, we're actually glad to be part of the revival of this genre because it seems like, you know, if we wouldn't have picked it up, it kind of would have slowly faded out
right after
a certain point. Just because, you know, the audience taste has shifted and nobody around the world really knew it. And the companies that make it, they know how to do one thing very well. They know how to make these movies. But
right, they
don't know how to market them, not overseas, not domestically even. They just sold them to pink theaters.
Right.
There's 80 pink theaters in Japan. 80 pink theaters in Japan, Ayumu?
No. Maybe.
There's 80 pink theaters in Japan, and they run the pink films, and that's it. And, you know, if these pink film theaters close, there goes the genre. So we're turning it into a bigger phenomenon for them, and that's actually hitting back over there. Because psychologically, in Japan, anything that's big in America is big in Japan. That's something
right,
that is just across the board over there. And so now that pink films are gaining a notoriety overseas, they're actually gaining a little more respect at home.
So where do you think the interest in pink films came from? Because arguably here in the U.S., it may, I'm just guessing here from what I've seen, it may have come down to those Tom Weezer guys, you know, the Video Search of Miami and all that. They did a whole bunch of guides about Japanese film, and they actually did a lot about, they had a book called The Japanese Sex Films, and it was this enormous, like, Bible-sized guide of basically all pink films back in the early to mid-90s. And then after those were out, all of a sudden a bunch of labels picked up and released, you know, little batches of these on DVD. But in Japan, that's what amazed me, that this has become, there's this resurgence of interest in the Katsu Library in particular, but also just this entire Pink Agave as a whole. It's become a big phenomenon where young women are really viewing these films and they're accepting them through a post-feminist lens. So it's really a big shift. It's a cultural shift.
Yeah, you know, again, we're happy to be a part of that. I think a lot of it is that it's post-feminist. I mean, a lot of these, the Groper Train films, per se, I mean, Groper
yes,
Train is the longest-running film series ever. There's more than 65 Groper Train films, which,
right,
of course, I have to say, a lot of them have nothing to do with each other. It's not like Star
yes,
Wars 1, 2, and 3 that have some sort of through line.
Right.
This is basically any film where there's a guy and a girl groping on a train is a Groper Train film. So they
right,
have their, it was a big series. This used to cater to the men's fantasy. It's like, wow, you get on a crowded train, there's a hot girl there, let's get groping here.
Right.
And then as soon as that became illegal and punishable very severely in Japan, those films kind of went away. But they're coming back now as like screwball comedies of like how life used to be. So
right,
then it's kind of, you know, in the 70s and 80s pink films, there's kind of like an homage to the old school. And that's kind of where this revival starts. And of course, because pink films were always like industry fringe rather than the,
right,
the machine girl type movies of Japan.
Right.
It seems like the directors could really get away with saying a lot of stuff like political stuff. In
yes,
the 60s and 70s, the pink films were very political.
Right.
And they were
yeah,
very critical of the government, and they were the avant-garde of the student movements in Japan and their revolt against what's going on in society. And
exactly,
that's something that people are looking on now in nostalgia. So that
right,
people have found their interest in this again just because it's cool.
Right.
You know, it's basically having its second wind now.
Yeah, and that's very true because you have people like Oshima and Koji Wakamatsu who are very much known for their political views and being very active. And that's where they did all their work in the pink films because, like you said, they can get away with it. As long as they put a sex scene in every 7 minutes, they could say whatever they wanted to, and there was no complaint. So,
exactly. The producers of the films really didn't care as long as there were sex scenes.
Exactly.
And that's what's great about this genre. Imagine that. Imagine you were coming to a Hollywood studio and said, hey, I have a great idea for a movie. And if the idea isn't, if they don't think it's great, you're not going to make the movie.
Right.
Whereas in Japan, if you can make the movie for the right budget And you can adhere to a couple simple rules. You know, just make sure there's a sex scene in it. Make sure there's a new face in it. And then you can do whatever movie you want. And that's how people like Yojiro Takeda got a chance to hone their skills and became, you know, he became the great director that he is today.
Right.
And Takahisa Zeze, who also, he just won the Berlin Film Festival.
Right.
We have one of his films released. We have Anarchy in Japan, a film that he directed. That's a film that he, basically, it's an experimental film. He just had some fun. As long as he stayed within the budgetary limits that they gave him, and as long as it was 60 minutes, and it had the amount of sex that, you know, made the producers happy, that's it. Just do whatever you want.
Right. And
it's rare to find such a creative opportunity in this business because, you know, at the end of the day, it is a business.
Right.
And in Hollywood, if you want to say something that's, you know, would be defamatory, then they won't let you. And, you know, because everybody's thinking about ticket sales. But in the pink films, because the bottom line price of the films is so cheap, and even if you made a really bad film, and there have been some bad films,
right,
they can sandwich it between two very good films. So then basically they would make money off of every film that they released.
Right.
And that's also unheard of over here. It's like, imagine every movie that you make makes money.
Right. And also, people don't even realize, you know, I don't have a lot in my head at this moment just on the fly here because I'm ad-libbing, but there were directors that are big names right now that really had started out making pink films that people wouldn't even picture because they're not making anything like this nowadays. Like, Kiyoshi Kurosawa started out making pink films, you know, and
yeah.
Now he's making nothing like that. You know, he's making films like Pulse and Charisma, and, you know, it's totally out in left field from, you know, the pink genre, and yet that's where he started out. That was where he learned his craft, and this was very common in the industry.
It's true. There are many actors as well. There are many you'll see in the pink films. If you get a chance to look at our releases on our DVDs, there's bios of all the actors. A lot of the actors are classically trained and went on to make, like, really big movies. Like, actress Yumi Yoshiyuki, that's in our Twilight Dinner, she was in Kill Bill.
Right.
She was in Ju-On. She was in the original Japanese Grudge.
The Grudge, right.
A lot of these actors are classically trained. And again, these are the parts that they can get. And then they go on to do big things.
You've been very involved in the festival circuit, screening these films and discussing them for audiences around the country. Tell us a bit about that end of your company. It's not something a lot of labels get involved with.
Well, we love the film festival circuit. It's a lot of fun for us. It's a great chance to promote our stuff overseas. And to us, again, as I said initially, this genre is sometimes misrepresented and misunderstood. People think that it's porn.
Right.
But when we release a DVD, if it's got a bunch of festival laurels on the front, if it played in 7 different film festivals, then you might think twice about it being just one of those porn flicks because people don't show porn flicks in Fantasia Film Festival
right.
and in the International Estonia Film Festival. I mean, they've screened our stuff on every continent of this planet and in film festivals, big and small, and we're happy to send our films to any film festival because we think it's great because we want people to see these films and
right.
especially see them on the big screen because they're
right.
intended to be big screen films.
Well, I'd love to know when you're coming around to the New York area because I would actually like to see one of these at a festival. That would be nice.
Okay, yeah, the New York Asian Film Festival in July will probably have one or two of our films.
Oh, great. Will you guys be there presenting?
We probably will, yeah. We went a couple years ago and 3 years ago. We've been going every year. Last year we actually didn't send somebody, but we've been going. And then they had us in Austin for like 3 years back-to-back in Fantastic Fest. And those are like bigger festivals. But then there's a programmer from England named Jasper Sharp.
Right.
Any film festival that he does, he's going to throw in one of our films. So he just did Poland and Estonia. So we conquered Eastern Europe also. We just had Berlin not too long ago. People love seeing pink films. I just got an email today from Boston. They're doing like a midnight program in theater in Boston, like
right.
a revival exploitation night, and they want to show some more films. We're happy to present our films on any big screen that will have us.
You're listening to Third Last Summer with our special guest tonight, Lot of Street of Pink Aga. Coming up, it's just a rubber train film, S&M Hunter, releases to date, and what's upcoming over here on Third Eye Cinema. to date. One thing I'd like to address is that despite having so many titles licensed and basically in queue, you seem to have released a relative handful on DVD to date. I think it's something like 20 films, but relatively speaking, for all the films you have out there, you know, that you have licensed, that's pretty small. So what factors are at work holding back the release schedule to something of a drizzle?
Well, we've released 16 as of today. The problem is, on our end, we feel like there's some sort of responsibility in what we do. Like, we're going to be, basically, every release that we do is the last time these films will ever get released.
Right.
The first and last time. And so we really pour our heart and soul into it. And so we try to put in 2 or 3 hours of extra content on each release.
Right.
And that's actually, I mean, that's very time consuming, but that's the fun part for us. The hard part for us is doing the subtitling, because we do the subtitling ourselves. We just, from Japan, we only get the master tape that just has the film on it.
Right.
We do a little bit of restoration in house. Like I said, we do post-production here, so we help ourselves to, like, some of our equipment. We do a little bit of color correction and restoration on it to make it look a little better, because the stuff we get from them is, how to say, kind of shabby.
Right.
And then we have to do all the subtitling ourselves. And a lot of the subtitles are very colloquial. It's like they'll say one thing and they mean something else. I mean, even when I saw Frankenstein Girl versus Vampire Girl, and the subtitles were terrible. There was, like, you know, strange punctuation. They just threw a bunch of periods in the middle of words and stuff like that. It was just weird. It just seemed like some kid did it.
Right.
And for us, I think we lose a big point if our releases aren't perfect. So it takes us a really long time to release a film because we want it to be perfect. You know, I'll happily push back a month and verify that it's perfect, then release something right now because we said we would and it'll be crummy.
Right.
It's not something that we do around here. It's a responsibility to our audience also. It's like if you're paying $20 for a 60-minute film, it should have as much extra content as possible. If we can get you a DVD commentary with a director, if that's something that is within our grasp, but we have to wait a week or a month for that, we'll wait. We want to do it right.
No, I agree. Also, your release schedule's been a bit erratic as well. You generally release two at a time. You put out 7 films in 2009. Then there was only 4 in 2010 and 2011. Can we expect any sort of a ramp-up in 2012, or is 4 a year basically what we should expect for the foreseeable future?
Well, I think in terms of what you can expect for the future, the first thing we're going to do is move our entire existing catalog over to VOD. That's before any new releases.
Okay.
We want to do VOD on them just because some people just want to watch the films and they don't want to own them.
Right.
And so we want to give our audience the opportunity to do that. It's like if you bought 5 of them and you're like, oh, you know, I already paid $100. I just want to watch S&M Hunter. So we'll give you the opportunity to, it's a click away rather than $20. And that, I think, is something that the economic feasibility of people watching more of this is easier for them. And it's great. Why not?
Right.
And so that's our next big project here, after which time we're probably going to release a movie called Made in Japan.
Would you say your emphasis in actual releases thus far is more on the recent wave, the post-millennial films, as opposed to the classic releases? Because I tend to gravitate towards the ones from the 80s in particular, the ones that, you know, maybe have a twist, some humor, and some relation to manga or larger-than-life characters. Some examples of what I'm talking to are the Groper Train series, Monster Train, the S&M Hunter films, Sexy Battle Girls, which is one of what apparently were several erotic takes in the Tsukuban Deika TV series and films. I know you have a few more of these in your licensed quiver, including, I think, 5 more Groper Train films. So I'm definitely looking forward to seeing more of these in release over the next, well, hopefully over the next year or so, but I'm not sure based on what you said.
Right. Well, you know, soon enough. I mean, I know it's been erratic on our end. Again, oftentimes we're waiting on materials from Japan.
Right.
To give the audience what we think would be the best that they can get. And as such, I mean, I know we get emails a lot from a lot of our fans that are like, hey, can't wait for the next release. And there is an element of pressure on us, you know, because it's always nice to have a new movie out.
Right.
But, you know, we're kind of taking our time with these because, again, we're looking for perfection. In terms of what we decided to release, a lot of it is just the movies that entertained us or kind of made us think. I mean, when we released The Lonely Cow Weeps at Dawn, which is to date one of our 3 bestsellers,
right,
that's a film that I really liked. But then everybody else said, wow, this is going to be, it's like financial suicide to release a film like that. It's basically, I don't know if you know the film, in short, it's about a man with dementia who gets up in the morning and goes to milk his cow in the cow shed. But his cow had actually died several years prior. And basically his daughter-in-law gets on all 4s naked in the barn and lets him milk her so that he can have his tradition.
Right.
And that, you know, the premise is slightly kinky, but the film, it's a very touching film. It's a moving film that deals with something that people don't really talk about. It deals with aging. It deals with, it's a very heartfelt drama of dedication and love. I really loved that film. I loved the way it looked. I loved the pace on it. I loved everything about it. It had a very kinky premise, yes, but aside from that, the film is amazing. So we said, let's release it because that's the film that we want to be out.
Right.
And we really thought that audience would not be responsive to this at all. We thought that people would hate it and would, like, walk away from us, but we felt like we need to release it anyway. And it's actually been a great success for us. And then after that, you know, we try to mix it up. We'll try to get a comedy in. We'll try to get a serious film. We'll try to get an action film. Because our point is that the pink film genre is so vast. There
right.
really is a little bit of everything. I mean, we just did a vampire one. You know, we did a science fiction one. We did an Armageddon one. We did a ninja one.
Right.
You know, there's basically a little bit of everything.
Right.
And that's something that we're trying to, at this point, we still have to prove. So that's how we determine what to release next.
Right. So in terms of the films that I was mentioning, like, you know, the Groper Transfers, the Sam Hunter films, Sexy Battle Girls, that kind of film, let's talk a little about those, because all of those would come off rather strange to Western eyes that aren't accustomed to Japanese cult cinema. So let's speak to Sexy Battle Girls first, for those who are unfamiliar with the Tsukuban Deika phenomenon. Tell us a bit about that connection.
Sexy Battlegirls is actually, it's a parody of a TV show
right.
that was in Japan that was called Tsukuban Deika, and then the film is called Tsukuban Deika, which means, it means panties instead.
Right.
It's a little nuance that perhaps the American audience will not get. You're right, but then, you know, it's kind of like, it's a silly, quirky film, and then that's the film that we showed. It premiered in San Francisco Indie Film Festival, and the audience just went wild. Again, it's one of these other films that we thought people wouldn't like so much. We just said, you know what, it's such a silly screwball comedy from,
right.
you know, it's an old comedy. You know, the Hollywood audience is not into that, but people just loved it.
Yeah,
it's,
I'm
it's
one
just
of them.
A fun little film.
Yeah, I love that movie. Another one of my favorites, the S&M Hunter series. The title's actually a bit misleading. For audiences, they're expecting something raw and kinky, like, you know, The Image or Tokyo Decadence. These films might be a real disappointment. But for crowds who like manga, they might come off too offensive, and I put that in quotes, you know, too off-putting in the sense of what the humor is being applied to. So tell us a little bit about those.
I hope that people don't get disappointed by S&M Hunter. S&M Hunter is actually, that's the film that's gone to the most amount of film festivals worldwide. I think that's, to some degree, the two or three films that are synonymous with Pink Eiga or with what we do is S&M Hunter, A Lonely Cow Weeps at Dawn, and The Japanese Wife Next Door. A Lonely Cow Weeps at Dawn is our heartfelt, sad, somber drama. And Japanese Wife Next Door is our dirty film. S&M Hunter is a little bit of both. It's like it's the 80s and it's large and in charge.
Right.
That's a film that actually they showed it at Austin Fantastic Fest. And then they called us back the year after that. And they played it at the Ritz in Austin, which is a 900-seat audience. And it was a sing-along.
Wow.
Like everybody just the movie and was they were clapping hands. It's like you'd have to see it drunk, which is what I guess everybody did. And it was just a big old party. It's a 60-minute party.
Right.
And that's a great thing. There is a prequel and a sequel, actually, that are totally slated to be released at a certain point. The prequel is a lot of fun. The sequel, well, it's a sequel. But, yeah, the prequel, I think people will get a kick out of. It's how he lost his eye.
Right.
And how he gets trained by the Dungeon Master. There's a lot of fun in there. The trailer is on our website. It's a funny little trailer.
Right, and I think you had mentioned when we were conversing by email that I had some good news in store for that, so I'm hoping that means a release date soon.
Yeah, so do I. yeah, we have to get in touch with Shiro Shimamoto, who is the S&M Hunter. We're trying to get an interview with him. We had Mr. Yutaka Ikejima, who is Mr. Pink, who's the Dungeon Master. He was
right.
in L.A. for a week
right.
last year, and when we showed S&M Hunter in L.A., he actually got on stage after the show, and he did the whole... He recited the whole Dungeon Master bit back to the audience live. That
wow.
was pretty... yeah, I mean, it's such a bigger subculture than it looks, and that's the great thing about it. We're having the best fun with this.
Exactly. And finally, speaking of titles that may be too bizarre for mainstream Western taste, let's talk about the Chikan Densha, Molester Train, Groper Trains theories, depending on what you want to call it. There were actually a fairly large number of these films produced. Like I think you mentioned there's about 50 of them during the 80s. But I understand they weren't really directly related. Two of the three you released, and we'll get to that in a bit, were the same characters, the Private Eye and his secretary girlfriend, and were very much playing in the comedy genre. I really loved these films. They were very amusing and fairly sexy, too. Tell us a little bit about that series.
Well, the Groper Train series is basically Pink Film back in the day used to cater to men's desires to the point where it would kind of they could act out their fantasies on screen. It's like you go to the Pink Theater and you see something that you're not allowed to do, something that's taboo. Again, imagine the 60s and the 70s before you could buy a porn DVD or just find porn on the internet anywhere.
Right.
And so people would go to the movie theater and they would see groping on the train, and it would act out their fantasies in the movie in the same way that we would go and watch, say, a Schwarzenegger movie and say, wow, he's a hero. I wish I was him.
Right.
You know, you can identify with the main character. That actually, that's has become a little shunned upon, let's just say, in Japan. It's frowned upon to see groping in a fond light. That's why they don't make these films anymore.
Right.
But, yeah, there is no common thread between them. They made 65 Groper Train films.
Wow.
In fact, Deep Contact, I released, is also, it's a Groper Train film.
Really? I didn't even know that.
Oh, sorry. No. Confused. I'm just looking at the titles here. Sexy Time Trip Ninjas, which is right over
here. Right, I was going to get to that in a bit. Right.
Yeah, Sexy Time Trip Ninjas is also, and it basically features those same two people. It features Detective Kuroda and his assistant Hama-chan are in that film as well. And these are all films directed by Yojiro Takita, who's an Oscar award-winning director.
Right.
You know, this is what he did before he did movies like Departure that granted him the Oscar for a foreign film in 2008.
You also have another 80s series license, the Hentai Byoto films. Tell us a bit about them and whether we can expect those coming in the future.
Oh, it's
a
Hawk Hospital.
It is. That's very similar. Those are actually directed by a female director in Japan.
Really?
Named Shizu Matoba. She's the most prominent Japanese female director. She's made over, Ayumu might have to help me here, 350 films have been directed by Shizu Matoba. Yeah, it's amazing the amount of stuff that these guys do. It's unbelievable. The Horror Hospital series is also a lot of fun. We were going to start by releasing the first Horror Hospital movie,
right.
But then that's something that we decided against because we didn't know how the audience would take it, and it's a very dirty film, quote unquote. It's more towards the less arty story ones.
Right.
And so we figured we want to get our a captive audience to understand that we also do the narrative based films first.
Right.
And then we're waiting a little bit with the Horror Hospital series.
Okay. Can you speak to the title switch in the Japanese Wife Next Door films? Because what was released here as number one was actually Family Gets Rude Chapter 2, Unequal Limits, and Part 2 was actually the first film of the two. I'm assuming you felt the second film was more marketable for whatever reason?
Well, first of all, I'm glad you did your research on this. This is true. But the Japanese Wife Next Door series is actually, it's a quote-unquote parallel universe story.
Right.
So basically, both of the films start exactly the same.
Right.
And so we have our guy walking into, you know, he had a crummy life, and he goes into a bar and he meets a girl and he marries her, and then his life just goes so much worse.
Right.
And so both of the films are, it's like it's a what if kind of scenario. What would have happened if he married the girl on the left? What would have happened if he married the girl on the right? What happens if you marry Reiko Yamaguchi? And what happens if you marry Akane Yazaki? And so there really is no importance to which one is part one and which one is part two. However, our audience have always been big fans of Reiko Yamaguchi's work.
Ah.
And she stars, we call The Japanese Wife Next Door Part 1.
Okay.
And this day, that film is our best seller. I mean, on websites like TLA Cult, that's
right.
Still one of their top 10 sellers ever.
Okay.
And it's just granted us, that's probably the film that put us on the map, because everybody's looking for that film everywhere we go.
Right.
And so I'm glad we did that one first to establish the series, and then we could actually, we put the second one out, which I think is actually a better film.
I thought that
was
too.
Sorry.
It is
a better film. It looks better.
But yeah, I was just wondering why you did the switch. But okay, it was because she was more popular. I get it.
Yeah, it's kind of like more, we just thought about that from a release perspective.
Right.
It just made more sense at the time.
And there was also a question regarding the titling of New Tokyo Decadence, The Slave. While I did enjoy the film, it really had nothing to do with the original, which was actually called Topaz in Japan, or its director, correct? Tell us a bit about this one.
And it had nothing to do, no. But then I guess a lot of people ask us about the names of our films. That's something that comes up a lot. For instance, everybody in the world is mad at me for naming a movie Anarchy in Japan. They say, how could you have done that? I'm sure that if that was your next question, then I'm sorry already. New Tokyo Decadence, it's kind of like supposed to play into the same realm of Tokyo Decadence.
Right.
But because it's a newer film, we called it New Tokyo Decadence, just kind of playing off of the original title a tiny bit. But
right.
Because the movie's called Dorei in Japanese, Dorei is the slave, we decided to give it the actual film name, which is The Slave.
Okay, so you were just going for what you thought the audience might be familiar with and say, okay, it's kind of like this film, so that's what we're going to put that title on.
Yeah, you know, it's the same Deep Contact. It also, it plays into a certain genre. It's a name that's familiar.
Right.
You know, it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with an original film with a similar name. It just happens to be called that. You know, it's just, that's just how we decided. I think for us, it's also internally, it's often very hard to come up with a name for a release because we fight about it long and hard, let's just say.
Right.
Our end.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's not like that's bad or anything. I was wondering why. This, you know, those are things that stood out to me.
No, it's all good. And I understand. You know, a lot of these are, you know, our primary concern on a lot of this is marketing. It's like if a movie has a very silly name, people are not interested in it.
Right.
And that's a silly thing because, you know, I guess people judge a book by its cover. Like,
yeah.
The content, it's still the same movie no matter what you call it.
Right. So one last titling switch. People may not realize that, and you have mentioned it already, but that Sexy Time Trip Ninjas was actually another entry in the Groper Train Molester Train series. So why did you change the title so radically that it didn't mention that it was one of these? And yet it was. It was very obviously one.
Just because we wouldn't want it associated with the other two Groper Train films that we've released. It is, in Japan, it is part of the Groper Train series. But the connection between this film and the other two Groper Train releases that we have is so far-fetched.
Right.
I mean, there's just that scene on the train where there's groping. But then this one, you know, it happens in the Meiji period in Japan.
Right.
It starts out in 17th century Japan, and then they kind of end up in the time warp, and they arrive in Tokyo in the 80s, and the ninjas start groping people on the train. You know, so that's where the groper train portion of the film comes into play. But it really has nothing to do with the other ones. And we didn't want it to feel like it's part of a series with those other two films.
Right. Am I forgetting, because it's been a bit since I've seen it, but weren't the same two characters, the detective and his assistant, in that film as well?
They were, yeah. Takeda loved using those two actors.
Right.
And they were prominent in many of his films.
Right.
And it's always fun to see them in a different capacity. They're two really good actors, by the way.
Yeah. I got a kick out of all those films. That's why I mentioned them. Both Ninja Pussycat and Sexy Time Trip Ninjas, which we just addressed, while these are from different eras, they both adhere to what appears to be a major and ongoing subgenre of pink film, the historical pink film. I know numerous companies have released what appear to be complete series in this subgenre. Media Blasters had all those Lady Ninja Kasumi and Lady Ninja Kaede films. Funimation had the Ninja Vixen films. Practically half of all the Switchblade cinema releases were of this type. Why do you think this subgenre is such a major segment of the pink industry and has become such a major chunk of all U.S. DVD releases of pink film?
Well, there's something about ninjas, I guess, that people really like it. Ask a ninja. It's like, you know, where are my ninjas at? People really like ninjas in America. I can't explain it. However, you should know, and I guess everybody should know, that Ninja Pussycat was the original. It came before the Lady Kasumi films, and it came before the Lady Kaede films. It came before any of these. It's a prequel
right.
to all of them. It's like the first pink ninja film ever made.
Right.
Not the first one ever released, but this is the original. This is like, you know, back to the source on this one. Kawasaki, the director, he didn't have a lot of money, but it's not apparent in the film. I mean, all the costumes he got from a theater. Like, he went to a theater and he like bartered the theater and got a bunch of costumes for his actors. And, you know, they got very creative on how to make this film within the budgetary means that they had to make it.
Right. So will you be tackling any pinky violence films? Because, you know, we could always use some more Miki Sugimoto films over this way. I'm a big fan of hers.
I see. Well, we'll see. There is part of my plan. I'm a big Asami fan. I don't know if you know Asami.
Yeah.
But I'm a big fan of hers, and we have some films of hers that are already subtitled. I mean, if I get to choose, I choose Asami personally.
Right.
But then the violence stuff in the companies that we work with, Shinto and Kokuei,
right.
they never did any violence stuff.
Right.
And then another production company in Japan, they have a rule, actually an unwritten rule, that says no blood. So you're not going to see from them, if we release any of their films, there will never be any blood in it. They don't like this stuff. They don't like the dirty stuff. They prefer, I guess in Japan is opposite than in America, they prefer the smut over the violence.
Right.
Whereas we always did everything opposite over here. So I guess the violence is permitted, but the smut is really bad.
Right.
In any case, yeah, I mean, I'm kind of like there's some of these films that I like a lot and some that I don't like a lot.
Right.
The Pinky Violence, though, it's not on our radar currently.
Okay. Who is, you had mentioned him already, but who is Mr. Pink, Yutaka Ikijima, and how did you come in contact with him? He seemed like a bit of a character from the extras.
Oh, Mr. Pink is a character. You don't even know the half of it. That man can drink anybody you know under the table. I've seen him smoking 2 cigarettes at a time and, like, doing shots off of a girl's ass in a party that we had here. He's crazy. Mr. Pink, I guess he started out his career as an actor in Pink films.
Right.
He used to be an audience member. Like, he used to go to the Pink films back in the day. He's 60-something years old, 65 years old, 63 years old. He used to go to, just as an audience member, just to watch Pink films. And then one day he said to himself, hey, I should do this.
Right.
It seems like it's a cool way to make money and, you know, have fun. So then he became a Pink film actor.
Right.
And then subsequently a Pink film director. And he's directed over 120 films already, acted in over 500.
Right.
So he calls himself Mr. Pink. He's self-titled, but he's the king of the genre. Like,
right.
He made 2 movies in 5 days. He made the Japanese Love Next Door series in 5 days with
wow.
a budget to shoot 1 movie. He shot 2.
Wow.
And he's amazing. He's at the top of his game at age 63, I guess, they're telling me here. And then every time you see him, it's not that he turns off when he doesn't shoot. He's the character that you see in his films. That's who the guy is. And he rolls like that, and he's proud of it. You know, he's proud to be in the Pink industry. It's a big part of his life. The way he sees it, he's making money, he's having fun, and he's fucking girls. So he says, hey, my life is perfect.
Sounds good to me. I'd like to have that one. Are there any other releases that you have out that you want to discuss, or any forthcoming releases you want to stump for before we close?
Let me see. I'm looking at the website. Let's see if there's any one that we didn't talk about. Yeah, I guess one that I'd like to note is, of course, Blind Love is the first one that we've seen. That's the movie that we decided to do Pink Aga because of.
Right.
That's the film that brought Pink Aga to America. And the newest release, Twilight Dinner, that just came out. And it's still kind of, it's not selling as well as we had expected, but it's still getting some love. That's actually, Mr. Pink did that one. That's his masterpiece. It took him 10 years to get that script made.
Wow.
He had the script. He was sitting on it for the longest time, and nobody wanted to make it. And then finally they made it, and then that's a film that we saw maybe 2.5 years ago, and I said, wow, we got to release this movie. And it took us a really long time to release because we put together a lot of extras on that. There's a commentary track. The commentary track on that is hysterical. It's Mr. Pink and Yumi Yoshiyuki, and she makes fun of him the whole time. They're just they're sitting around and they're laughing at it. It's just, that's a fun ride. The film itself is great. I think it's underappreciated. I guess Greg from Cinesploitation, I think he said it was one of the best releases of the year, and that's a guy that sees a lot of horror films.
Right.
You know, they did, like, in terms of low budget, they stretched their yen on this film. It looks like it's a much bigger production than it is, and it's a fun film, and I think people should check it out.
Tell us a little bit about the plot, because I know it's a horror film, but, you know, tell me some of the particulars.
Well, what happens in the film is basically there's a strange couple of women move in next door to this guy,
right.
And then his life changes when he starts dating one of them, and then they're sisters. It turns out that they're sisters, and they live in the dark. It's basically a modern vampire story in Tokyo. But there aren't any fangs. It's like a Pink take on a vampire movie. You
right.
know, it's very practically shot. And with that in mind, there's a gore scene in it that you're not going to believe that they did in 4 hours.
Really?
I can tell you, yeah, the climax of the film is shocking in many ways. And then, to me, I've seen a lot of Pink films because we
right.
basically have to decide which one to do next.
Right.
And it's hard for me to be surprised by a Pink film because, you know, on a 60-minute low-budget film, how many plot twists can you have that would
right.
surprise you?
Right.
It's got, the end of it is just shocking. You just sit there, and it's mesmerizing in many ways. And we recently saw it on a big screen. There was a screening here. We saw it again on a big screen, and it's just a great big screen and little screen film.
So any other releases you want to discuss?
Wait till you see Made in Japan, a new one that's coming out soon. It's like a maid genre, you know, where they have the
right.
maid cafes in Japan. So
right.
it's kind of like a take on the maid cafe. It's that one is actually, we don't have a date yet, but it's kind of flimsy on plot.
Right.
So to speak, but the girls in it are very hot. So we feel
yeah.
like we're going to get a lot of love from our audience for that because everybody likes seeing hot girls in their Pink films.
I was going to say the few of those kind of films that came over here, I've enjoyed them all. So I'm looking forward to that.
I'm happy to hear that. I'm happy that you're such a fan of the genre. It's such a labor of love on our end. It's like, you know, again, we're working against being so misrepresented everywhere we go. It's like, oh, yeah,
right.
you guys, you're the guys that do the Japanese porn. It's like, no, it's not Japanese porn. And it's such an uphill battle in many ways, especially, you know, nowadays. Being a DVD release company in this economic climate and, you know, in the digital world, it seems like it's a step back in the curve. That's why we're doing the VOD thing. We're adding a VOD theater to our site So people will be able to watch the films online as well, and we're hoping that's going to catch on.
So anything else you want to discuss before we close? You know, any releases that you think you're going to have more or less on schedule? Like, you know, I'm still stumping for the S&M Hunter one, or...
Your vote has been noted, and it's totally in the list, you know.
Okay.
That one is in a very advanced place in subtitling. Just so you know, again, between me and you, we go through the subtitles on every film 4 times. We have the first translation that we do on each film. It's just a literal dictionary translation, like somebody will go through the Japanese and write, type it in English.
Right.
The second pass, we give that DVD, we give a screener of that to a writer that we work with, and he'll kind of polish up the English and throw in some jokes.
Right.
And then come back, we do the timing on it, because sometimes there's a lot of dialogue that needs reading, so we have to truncate the subtitles.
Right.
And then it goes through a fourth pass that just reads everything and makes sure there's no punctuation errors and all the caps are capped and everything makes sense, because sometimes things fall through the cracks. So then for us to subtitle a film, you know, again, we're doing all of this on our own, so it takes us a really long time. But just so you know, S&M Hunter Begins, it's already stage 3 here, so... yeah. Oh, you're going to love it. It's such a silly movie.
I don't know if it'll top the other one, but I'm still looking forward to it.
It's very hard, you know. The second one, like the middle one of the series, the one that's out...
Right.
That's the best one of the three. The third one, I think, personally, again, don't quote me on this, is really bad. But the first one, it's always nice to have a prequel. It's kind of like, how did he lose the eye? What's going on here? How did this happen?
Right, exactly.
You get that.
And how about, you mentioned you were holding off on the Horror Hospital ones. How about the Groper Train series? Because you still got about 5 or 6 films in queue that you have licensed.
There's so many of those. There's so many. I think, well, the closest ones to expect... probably Made in Japan, which I know we're doing next, followed by The Orgasm Counselor, which is also another Chise Matoba film. She makes the dirty ones. She's the female director of all the dirty films. And then maybe S&M Hunter Begins. Who knows what's in store?
Sounds good. Well,
yeah, I wish I had more definite dates on my end. And I can tell you that Ayumu is knocking on my door every day and saying, when are we doing this? When's the next release? Well, what are we waiting for? And then, you know, sometimes we're just waiting.
Right.
You know, it just has to be perfect. If we don't have a good box art, or if the trailers aren't right, or if the extra material is not lined up, we can't release it, because we respect our audiences and we want to give them the best.
Right.
You know, once a movie's released, it does not get re-released. So then if the release is shabby, it's going to stay shabby. And that's something that if I were a movie, I would want to have a good release, not a bad release.
True. Actually, you mentioned the box art, and that brings another question to mind. You had released S&M Hunter, and I have the original cover because I got it when it first came out. And then you had released another cover, which was more of like a line art kind of a thing. Why did you release a second cover?
Well, the first cover, it was kind of like my homage to the Indiana Jones series. There's an over-shoulder shot of Indiana Jones standing there with his gun that we saw somewhere and we said, wow, that would be great for S&M Hunter. So we kind of put him in that position. Like, it's a very, you know, it's a very militaristic type pose.
Right.
And we liked that cover a lot. It was the first DVD we ever made, and we thought it was great. We were very proud of it. And then this Canadian blog writer / cartoonist / artist named Robin Boogie wrote a little piece about our films. He was writing a lot of great stuff about us, and he said, you know, but the only thing I really hate is the box cover for S&M Hunter.
Really?
And he said, well, Robin, you know what? If you can make a better box cover, go ahead. And so he did. And
wow.
So this is the Robin Boogie box cover. He's a very renowned artist in the world of cult comics in Canada. He does a lot of great stuff. And so it was actually, for us, it was a great honor. We were going to do Sexy Battle Girls with him as well, but then we just kind of, that one also had a different box cover. We released that one on our own. But, you know, now and then we try to switch it up just because it's sometimes it's more fun to look at, you know, the same film with a different box cover. Why not?
Okay, well. With that, Ayumu, since you're in the back, I'd like to thank you for joining us here on Third Eye Cinema, and I hope to have you on again in the future to discuss any new releases or the pink film genre in general.
Great. Thank you so much for having us, and yeah, we look forward to a good year from us.
Take care.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye now.
In the Third Eye Cinema, and coming up we have some brief promos of my man Jackie Slaughter from Skullfist, who will be on next week, just as a teaser. Coming up on Third Eye Cinema. of next week's, one of next week's guests, Jackie Slaughter from Skullfist. This, you get to hear a little bit of the behind-the-scenes conversation that usually doesn't get aired. But Jackie is so entertaining, I'm giving you two little bits here just as a promotional tool. First off, he's talking about our first guest, Jill Janis from Huntress, who had just rung off. And Jackie will be briefly touring with Huntress when they're up in Canada. So let's hear a little bit of that. I know, I just finished up the other person like a second ago.
Is that what I was hearing?
Yeah, I literally just hung her up and got you.
Oh, because I heard,
you know, you were really, really well prepared, and I really like that. Thank you.
And I was like, I thought that was the interview chick, eh? I was like, what a weird thing to say to somebody.
She was in another band. It's a band called
Huntress. What was the band?
Huntress.
Huntress? That's a chick from Huntress?
Yep.
No, dude. Oh, yep. Man, that's so fucking weird, man, because, I literally just found out about that band, like, about 2 weeks ago, because they're on the same booking agency as us in the States, eh?
Oh, really?
Yeah, and they're playing. So, anyways, I was looking through the bands that are on our booking agency, and I was like, what's this Huntress band? So I was just checking them out, and then, of course, obviously, I noticed that she's ridiculously hot.
Exactly, right.
Dude, she's super hot.
And
she's told her band's totally playing here next month. Yeah, see, that's great. Is she cool?
She's awesome.
Oh, man.
You know, from watching the video and stuff, I figured she'd be a little more intimidating, but nah, she's laid back. Huh?
That's how it always is, though. It's like you watch like these like grindcore death metal bands freaking out, and then it turned out to be like nice, easygoing people.
I know. And here's another brief one, which will be our last one for the evening, where we're talking about the Canadian invasion.
That East Coast accent? Yeah, see, that's where people get that Canadian accent from. I mean, like, I guess, you know, some Canadians like us, like, we say some words differently. But the mega Canadian accent is always East Coast, man. Like Newfoundland and shit, man.
Well, Newfoundland's completely different, but...
Dude, but yeah, you know, fucking doo-doo-doo-boo-dit.
Donaire's poutine and garlic fingers.
I totally just ate poutine like fucking an hour ago.
I'm jealous. We cannot get poutine down here. It's like, you know, we were getting cheese curds and making our own for a bit, but they don't even sell the freaking cheese curds anymore.
You know what, man? In Quebec, in the province of Quebec, man, poutine is like God in there, man. Shit is so good, too.
It's like, too bad it rots. It's like, hey, when you come down for your show, bring down poutine.
Yeah, really?
All right.
Someone should be smart and open up a poutine place in, like, New Jersey or New York, man. I bet you it'll work.
And, you know, they brought Tim's down here. They got one in the city. I don't know if it worked out or not, but they were trying to compete with Dunkin' Donuts, so.
It just came to Toronto last year.
Right.
And now there's, like, 10 of them all around, and they're, like, unbelievably busy, eh?
Exactly.
Yeah, it's fucking pretty badass.
Yeah, I actually have a friend up there that brings us coffee. We got the tins of Tim's coffee.
The Tim Horton stuff.
Right.
Yeah. I think that's slowly... It's not Canadian-owned anymore anyway. It's like Wendy's owns it, so...
Oh, really? I didn't even know that.
Yeah. So I figure... I mean, it's probably going to pop up at some point. Because you guys pretty much just got Starbucks. Like, what's the other coffee place?
Starbucks is really the big one, and everybody just swears by Dunkin' Donuts.
I guess so, yeah. So that's like Tim Horton's bucket, but probably all ass down there. Oh, Canadian invasion owned by America.
Well, we're going to try to make this a Canadian invasion of bands because I'm going to be talking to Cauldron, too. So.
Oh, no shit.
Okay. So that was our little promo clips. So we'll close out the show. Here we go. Well, thank you for joining us tonight. We hope you enjoyed our up-close and personal interview with Not of the Street of Pingaga. Next week on Third Eye Cinema, we're talking music with two up-and-coming traditional metal bands, the bewitching Jill Janis of Huntress and the irrepressible Jackie Slaughter of Skullfist, who you just heard a little from. If you'd like to contact us here, comments, suggestions, or if you're a filmmaker or musician who'd like to join us on air, email us at thirdeyecinema@hotmail.com or visit our Facebook page, facebook.com/thirdeyecinema. Third Eye Cinema, brought to you by the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk. We'll be right back.
If you missed any part of this or any other Third Eye Cinema broadcast, just visit our Facebook page for links to the shows in question. All Blog Talk Radio shows are available for archive listener download at your convenience.
Let's say you just bought a house. Bad news is, you're one step closer to becoming your parents. You'll proudly mow the lawn, ask if anybody noticed you mowed the lawn, tell people to stay off the lawn, compare it to your neighbor's lawn, and complain about having to mow the lawn again. Good news is, it's easy to bundle home and auto through Progressive and save on your car insurance, which, of course, will go right into the lawn. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company, affiliates, and other insurers. Discount not available in all states or situations.